Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. Soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bedeque Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show can be podcasts from Radio for All and is archived a week after airing on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can contact us for ideas and comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Asheville FM is celebrating 5 years with an epic dance party featuring DJ Diesel, DJ Harry Darnell, and Asheville FM's own DJ Malinali. It takes two to tango, so we've invited our friends at Asheville Writers in the schools and community to join us for a benefit for our two nonprofits. Ticket purchases include a raffle ticket, so stay tuned to ashevillefm.org for information on the raffle. The benefit will be held at the Orange Peel on Friday, September 12th. Doors open at 8, dance party starts at 9. There's a $5 donation, again including the raffle ticket. This episode will be featuring a conversation with Amélie Trudeau and Falon Rouillet, two Quebecois anarchists imprisoned in Santa Marta prison in Mexico. Amélie and Falon, alongside of Carlos López Marín, make up the 5E3, who are being charged by the Mexican state for an arson of a Nissan dealership and neighboring Ministry of Communication and Transportation in January of this year. We talk about prison, freedom, dignity, solidarity, and more. For more info on the case of the 5E3, check out our episode of August 10th, 2014, where we talk to one of their supporters, and you can find links to sources of their writing and updates. Then we'll continue our chat with Alexander Abbasi, a Palestinian-American living and studying in the U.S. This will pick up where the chat in the latter half of the prior episode left off, that being August 24th, 2014, covering decolonization, personal views on political development, and resistance. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
The American public school system devoted 12 years to convincing us that the United States is the land of the free and the home of the brave, that this country is exceptional, guaranteeing freedom. The U.S. commitment to human rights makes it the greatest country in the world, according to the story it projects, to every corner of the globe. So let's talk about human rights in the American. The Organization of American States, OAS, is a treaty organization. It was founded in 1948 under the United Nations Charter. And 36 nation states in the Americas are member states of the OAS, including the United States. The principles of the OAS are related in the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man, a pretty radical declaration as far as hierarch state worshippers go. Besides the criminal justice rights normally understood and the right to freedom of belief and speech, the American Declaration lists freedoms like the right to residence and movement, right to asylum, right to health, right to culture, education, and fair pay, all rights that go even beyond the U.S. Constitution guarantee. The OAS has generated a number of human rights conventions that 36 member states can sign, ratify, and then recognize the international court's authority to enforce. You've got the American Convention on Human Rights and the additional protocol to the American Convention, both designed to codify the lofty ideas presented in the American Declaration. Then you've got the Protocol to Abolish the Death Penalty, the Convention to Prevent and Punish Torture, the Convention on Forced Disappearances, the Convention on the Prevention, Punishment, and Eradication of Violence Against Women, and the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Persons with Disabilities. Of the 36 member states of the OAS, only 3 of them have signed on to all 7 of those documents, ratified them, and then recognized the international courts authority to enforce them. 3 other member states have refused so much as to sign any of them. The remaining 30 states signed some, but not all. A mixed bag. Now, the United States, the exceptional nation for its unwavering commitment to human rights, where would you expect the U.S. to fall on the spectrum of things? It would make sense for the U.S. to be one of the 3 nations to ratify all 7 human rights conventions, wouldn't it? I mean, most of those commitments are no-brainers. Convention to Prevent and Punish Torture, or Forced Disappearance, it would make sense for the U.S. to be one of the 3 nations to ratify all 7 human rights conventions, wouldn't it? I mean, most of those commitments are no-brainer. Convention to Prevent and Punish Torture, or Forced Disappearances, Violence Against Women, Discrimination Against the Disabled, Certainly the U.S. is opposed to all of that, right? No. Of the three nations that are exemplary for their commitment to human rights, ratifying all seven conventions, the U.S. is not one of them. The three nations are Costa Rica, Ecuador, and Uruguay. Those are the three countries that have put their money where the United States' mouth is. So what is it that makes the U.S. exceptional in the realm of human rights? Well, sadly, the U.S. is one of three nation states that refused to sign any of the convention. That's right. The U.S. will not abolish the death penalty. Further, it won't even promise to prevent or punish torture. Yeah, the U.S. reserves recourse to torture. The U.S. won't pledge to refrain from forced disappearances. It reserves the right to drag away its critics to government black site. The U.S. won't so much as oppose violence against women or discrimination against the disabled. And to be clear, we're not even talking necessarily about submitting to international courts here. We're just talking about signing documents to condemn torture, disappearance, violence against women, discrimination against the disabled. That means 33 other countries of the Americas, including Venezuela, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Honduras, not exactly countries you associate with stellar human rights records, have demonstrated greater commitments to human rights than the United States have. I think that makes the United States pretty exceptional in the realm of human rights.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
It's competing with Antigua and Barbuda to see who can demonstrate the most contempt for international standards that are embraced by Costa Rica, Ecuador, and Uruguay. Land of the free, home of the brave, don't buy the hype. The U.S. reserves the right to black site and torture you, smack your mom, kick over that kid's wheelchair, and lethally inject all of you. Makes you wonder how to get asylum in Uruguay, huh? This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with Amelie Trudeau, an anarchist currently imprisoned in Mexico as part of the 5E3 case. Thanks a lot. It's really good to chat with you, Amelie. Can you tell us if there are any updates on your case? What have you been convicted of, and what kind of time are you facing?
It's been a while that, like, we are waiting now for updates. Like, we didn't have updates since a couple of months. We are still waiting for, like, our sentence. We have, like, two cases, one, like, estatal and one federal. So, like, the estatal one, like, is the original one that we had at the start. And it's, like, accusation of daños a la propiedad, which is like damage to property, in pandilla, which is mean like in group of like three, and ataca a la paz pública. So this is for the estatal case, and for the federal case, we are accused of incendio of a public edifice with people like inside. So, like, for the estatal one, like, right now, I think we think that the minimum that they can give us is, like, 6.5 years. And for the federal one, like, the minimum is 5 years. We did, like, a bureaucratic measure that's called an amparo against, like, our, like, incarceration here. But it got negated. So right now we are going to the sentencing soon, and the Mexican bureaucracy is very long, so yeah, we might wait another like maybe 2 months before to know like more what's going on, and before that we can go in appellation and we can do another amparo, and yeah, like we don't know how it's gonna go. Like, also everything is super corrupted here, and they can like invent evidence to keep us inside or invent other accusations. So yeah, But at least we have we have a solid crew outside that that is there with us.
Do you think that after sentencing you're still going to be in Santa Marta, or do you think you might be transferred?
Well, there is a possibility that they transfer us to federal prison if we are accused of for the federal accusation of arson to the public edifice with people inside. But we can also stay here. Like, in this prison in Santa Marta, there's also federal.
Yeah. One thing that's really impressed people about your case has been about how you've chosen to deal with the idea of innocence and guilt when engaging with the legal system. Can you talk a little bit about what that decision means to you to say that I'm not going to cop a plea and I'm not going to say that I'm innocent?
Well, because basically, I will talk for myself. I don't want to talk about for Fallon or for Carlos, but for myself, I would say that, like, for me, the justice system, like, I don't believe in it, and, like, it's bullish. So, like, whether to be, like, guilty or innocent, for me, doesn't make any difference, because, like, my intention is to fucking fight this world. So, like, it's, I feel that if I would say, like, oh, no, like, I'm innocent, it's like if I would bend in the front of, like, the state, and, yeah, like, I don't know, I assume my ideas as anarchist, and I don't want to, like, enter in their game, more or less.
Yeah.
But, like, I would say that there's different ways to interact with justice when, like, we're facing repression, and this is a question that, like, it's really here that I start to ask myself those questions and to observe, like, what other anarchists, what they did or how did they react. Like, I'm looking at other cases of anarchists in Spain, in Greece, in Mexico, or to compare and to make, like, my decision about how I want to interact with justice system. And, like, there's maybe two different positions that I would, like, agree with. It's like the one say, like, okay, I'm not guilty, I'm not innocent. And we have a lawyer, and the lawyers, like, try to make that, they don't have, like, a lot of, like, they don't have proof against us, so maybe we can go out like that. But, like, the other way people react usually with that is, like, or not usually, but sometimes people decide to just, like, not interact with the justice and not go to court and, like, not present thing and, like, take the responsibility of, like, the act they did. And, like, this is another thing, you know, it's, like, another way to interact with justice. So in their case, like, we assume our ideas and we say that we're not innocent and we're not guilty neither, and we just don't want to play their game. That's pretty much it.
That makes a lot of sense. That seems like a very difficult stance to take when the alternative means compromising yourself before the court system, which is a BS system, but having a decreased sentence, maybe. But I understand choosing the path of dignity, and I respect it very much.
Yeah, but I feel that, like, all my life I would regret it, you know? Like, for me, it's really, like, a dignity, like, to keep my dignity, like, as a person with my idea and my struggles, so... Like, my ideas have more value than, like, my freedom outside and the fact of being outside. Like, for me, the important is, like, to be in prison make me realize a bit, like, more what means freedom, actually, you know?
Yeah. How's your conception changed about what freedom means?
Well, I would say that before I was scared of the prison. And I was, like, scared of the isolation, and I was like, oh, it's going to be very, very hard. And I didn't know, like, it's, like, the other side of the mirror.
Yeah.
It's, like, another reality. But since we are here, it's, like the everyday life can look the same as outside. Like, it can feel the same as outside, you know? Like, there's building, and there's walls, and, like, there's guards, but... Like, the discipline is not that much in this prison, either. So, like, it's more a matter of how I feel with myself in my head.
So you and Falun Ruyeh are in the same prison, and Carlos is in a different one and has faced different things, and also has a child on the outside. Can you talk about Carlos's situation?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I will be brief, but our prison is pretty different than the one where Carlos is. I don't know. I would say, for example, in Carlos' prison, like, they are in a room with, like, 7 beds. They can be 30 people in the room for 7, a small cell, you know? So, like, there's all those power dynamics. There's, like, people who give order to others. Like, there's a lot of corruption. Like, all the guards are corrupted, and, like, the guards are working with the inmates to exploit the other prisoners. And, yeah, like, for example, if you don't want to wash the floor every day for 7 hours a day, you need to pay, like, 3,000 pesos, for example, to, like, other inmates and to the guards. If you don't pay, they will just, like, humiliate you and beat you up. Like, there's a lot of extortion like that. And a lot of, like, violence. There are, like, 12,000 prisoners in this prison. There's a lot of drugs, too. And I don't know, it's not, like, you need to fight sometimes if you don't want people to steal your shoes or... Yeah. I think you had to fight a couple of times.
That sounds really rough.
Yeah.
And the way I think you've described in your letters, forgive me if these are Fallon's words, but I recall words describing your prison as being like a village on the inside.
Yeah, where we are, like, we are unlike the cell in the morning at 8 in the morning, and they lock us up at night at 8. And during the day, we can do pretty much whatever we want. There's a lot of activities, like, there's a garden, there's a school, you can make sports. The guards are, like, we just need to pass, like, a list to give our name, like, 3 times per day, and that's it. Yeah, so, like, the time passed. That's pretty much it. It's very different.
Do you have any words that you want to share with people in the audience, or any shout-outs in general?
Well, I would say that, like, the reason why I participate to this radio show is because, like, I don't know, like, maybe last year I was in France. I was in Paris, and I had friends there who did, like, radio show for prisoners. And, like, the prisoners were calling and doing interview, and it was, like, a point of, like, communication between, like, different prisoners in different prisons. And I think that it's pretty strong to have, like, a solidarity between, like, prisoners, and especially between anarchist prisoners, because we can... Like, there are things that we can share. So, I don't know, I would say give strength to people outside, inside. And I believe that it's, like, sometimes we feel isolated with our ideas when we're in prison, like, as anarchists. I think that it's good to be open with ideas and to try to bring on the table, like, in our relationship that we build up with, like, other prisoners, to try to be able to build up, like, relationship of equality and maybe collectivity, because, like, to fight against the power dynamic inside the prison between the inmates is, like, a first step for me to build up, like, a solidarity between prisoners, which is something that, like, it's needed if you want to organize whatever struggle inside the prison. So, yeah, just, like, keep, like, the head up and to... Yeah, that's it. I would pass the phone to Falun.
Okay, please.
Because we still have, like, 5 minutes and a half.
Okay, thank you.
Hey!
How are you doing?
Good, yourself?
Falun Ruyeh, could you introduce yourself, and do you have any words for people on the outside that you want to spread?
Sorry, there's a lot of, like, noise, so you have me to, like, introduce myself, and what?
Yes, please. And if you have any words that you would want to spread to other prisoners or anarchists?
My name is Fallon, as you probably know. And if I have something to say to, like, other prisoners or other anarchists, is that I feel that being in jail is just, like, part of the struggle, and it's just something really normal, and we, like, we don't have to, like, change our position when we're inside, and sometimes it's, like, hard to, like, challenge ourselves with, like, the justice system and, like, collaboration and that and stuff like this, but I think we need to, like, stay strong and don't do, like, the same thing as the state wants us to do. And, yeah.
Fallon, have you heard about the solidarity actions on the outside, and how did it feel to hear about them?
It's really nice. Like I'm going to talk for myself. So it's really nice to, like, read something about, like, in solidarity with us. But I feel, too, like, that I hope that, like, there's a lot of, like, other actions happening who's not in solidarity with us. I feel that sometimes, like, people are going to, like, start to, like, have, like, a partial struggle for, like, some prisoners. And, of course, like, it's really fun to read something in solidarity with us, but I hope that, like, people don't need, like, prisoners to do actions. I don't know if you know what I mean.
Like, making sure that the struggles are their own struggles, and also keeping in mind prisoners and others.
Just that, like, the struggle needs to, like, continue as, like, we always did it. And it's nice to, like, do some action solidarity with, like, prisoners. But I think we need to be careful with that, too, in the sense of, like, the... like, don't, like, fuck all these early actions into, like, prisoners, but more, like, into, like, the larger struggle.
That makes sense.
No, I'm clear. Sorry. My English is really bad those days.
No. It's great. It's a lot better than my French. So, you've been getting support from Cruz Negra in Mexico City, right?
Yeah.
How's that been?
Well, since we were in jail, like, when we were at the Hegel Center, we didn't, like, receive any visit for like, your friends or families. So the lawyer was here, and, like, people from the, like, Cruz Negra, like, the ABC here, were, like, always outside giving them, like, books and stuff like this. And the first visit we had here was from someone for Cruz Negra, and they're, like, the group was, like, really always there. Like, they come to visit us, like, every week. So, like, and it's nice in this way. But in the same way, like, we don't have that much of, like, affinity with them. But I appreciate the fact that they are, like, really present with us. Because sometimes we have visit, but it's going to be, like, visit for, like, 2 weeks or something. And those folks are coming here, like, every week. And they're, like, doing some contacts with people in Montreal to give them some news or something. They're, like, kind of like an organization who help us with, like, communication and visit and money and stuff like this.
That's good. It sounds like they're pretty solid folks, even if you didn't know them before.
Yeah, I think that people from the Cruz Negra are really solid. I have my own distance from, like, their ideas and stuff like this, but I feel for, like, solidarity with prisoners, they're really solid and, like, consistent. And, like, every time we need something, like, we can call them, oh, the phone card's gonna die.
Thanks so much for doing it, and thanks to Amelie, too.
Okay, so have a good day, and continue the struggle.
Okay, bye. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. Soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bedeg Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Up next is the final half of the interview with Alexander Abbasi, a Palestinian-American living and studying in the U.S. We discuss a wide range of topics, starting off with our own personal views on political development, the decolonization of people and land bases, and the resiliency of people in the face of widespread murder and oppression by governments. All that and more after this musical break.
I guess one thing, as someone who self-identifies as an anarchist, I have this hiccup, like knee-jerk reaction against representative organizations that maybe are vying for... So, okay. Part of my political development was looking at the struggles in Northern Ireland, because I was looking back to my own personal ancestry. When I looked at the different factions that were operating in Northern Ireland among the Republican elements, at their best times, they were Bobby Sands, they were like citizen militias defending neighborhoods from onslaughts of racially driven hate crimes. They were also attempting to not draw lines between different movements and between different communities based on ethnicity or religion. They were attempting to say, yes, we have different people who are, some of us are of Scottish descent and Protestant, and some of us are of, have been, our ancestors have been in Ireland longer and they're Catholic or non-practicing. And the nationalistic imagery of division between those communities, certain strains of the IRA recognized, fostered the rule from above and the creation of second and third class citizens that kept them competing with each other for resources and kept each other down, basically. But at the best of times, Republicans were fighting against racism and in solidarity with other people and putting their lives on the line and trying to be good feminists and trying to, you know, stop gay bashings and what have you. And at the worst of times, they operated as a mafia because they were so focused on making sure that their political machine continued surviving, because they believed without that organization there was no struggle. And I can't speak to the situation in Palestine concerning groups like Fatah, Hamas, PFLP, and others that are resisting and have been resisting since the 60s, I guess, in their current forms. But I see a sort of possible comparison between the circumstances as as nations suffering under the yoke of colonialism and competing nationalities. Do you see where I would be concerned about, like, why, what is the best way to offer solidarity with the people of Palestine, but not get caught up in the factional politics of different organizations?
Yes, I hear you, Bruce. I'm first going to address one thing before jumping to your question at the end, because I think it lays a good basis. So just allow me to work through it for a moment.
Definitely.
I think we always have to contextualize, because the nationalist movements of our past, the revolutionary nationalist movements of our past, came as specific responses. And that is what those ancestors of ours saw as the necessary response for them to survive, to resist, and to keep on living and passing down the tools that are needed to dismantle the system. So I think we need to historicize and be very careful to not look back on those situations with our current consciousness now. I'm not saying that you're doing that. I'm just setting the ground. Because yes, we can critique nationalism, especially now, and I'm not into nationalism. I think it perpetuates the Nakba. I wrote this poem, If I Were to Say Death, and I go through, if I were to say death to Hitler, would that be more palatable? If I were to say death to apartheid South Africa, would that make more sense? If I were to say death to Israel and Zionism, which I do, would a Palestinian voice finally be heard? But I also say within there, if I were to say death to Palestine post-liberation for the ways in which secular nationalism can perpetuate otherizing people, can perpetuate these notions of identity that pit us against each other. So I'm not saying that all forms of anarchism or leftist thought, Eurocentric leftist thought, operate in this way. But I'm tired of the talk of decentralization and of non-hierarchy. I don't necessarily know what it means for us. I know what it means in terms of what we don't like about them, but I think we have to view it in a different way. Because what this type of non-hierarchy, decentralizing, kind of anti-power view of power itself, it really has us marching around like a bunch of deconstructed, egotistical i-gods. You know, the European philosophy became God. The white man with a long flowing beard up in the sky with a cane, this became our image of God, white Jesus. This is what we now worship. And it's a very individualistic, you know, the human went from Homo sapien to Homo economicus. Human is just a consumer now. Do we really need to have to organize with this focus on me, me, me all the time and always have the right of every single person's opinion needing to be enshrined, worshipped, and heard for every single decision? I think in certain ways it's self-centered and it's inefficient because of the overemphasis on the individual and really nothing on the responsibility of how we collectively organize and rely on each other or how we can put more trust into the we of each other's judgments and positions. How can we sometimes just not even ask questions? How can we be more needy of each other and less needy towards that egotistical I God within us? How can we develop that ability to submit to the commands made by our comrades and our leaders and the demands of the group? And if you look at this within the context of what they've done to our movements, it's like they've diminished us to ants, and we don't know how to build communal leadership or trust amongst each other anymore. I think this is why certain people within the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the U.S., and I've seen this in other movements, it's why certain conflicts remain. You know, the territory is kind of up for grabs for everybody because we're too ragtag. But, I mean, this is what the powers that be did. They created these generational gaps, the long-term trauma between us. It's because of the decades of repression and degeneration of the movements. It's because of this system's, this white supremacist, modern colonial, racist, sexist system, its ability to decentralize us and undo our hierarchies, which are much different from their hierarchies. It's to undo our institutional power. It's their ability to steal and suppress our knowledges of self and self-autonomy. You know, in terms of students working towards divesting from those companies complicit in Palestinian human rights abuses in the university context, Palestine Solidarity activist students are very good at attempting to decentralize and de-hierarchicalize the university's power. But then we go on forgetting how to centralize and properly organize ourselves. I think power and hierarchy are neutral formats. They're neutral systems. They can be used to liberate and to re-spread power, or they can be used to dominate and abuse the power. So I don't necessarily think that it should be about decentralizing power. I think it should be about re-centralizing power, which is a very indigenous way to look at things. It's a very decolonial way to look at things. And very quickly, to answer your question about Palestine, how we can be in solidarity, there was a recent piece that came out. An interviewer got a very exclusive interview with Hassan Nasrallah, one of the heads of the public spokesperson and head of Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiite revolutionary organization. And he, you know, often the media and the Western media and mainstream media, they put it so deep within us. They put Islamophobia so deep within us and such a Eurocentric worshiping cosmology within us that we really demonize them. I mean, not only do they label them as terrorists, but they don't even take what they say as valid. And they think, oh, these are just some crazy religious extremists who don't buy into this model. Well, yeah, the Muslims in the world are some of the last people who are not buying into this system. And look what they call them. They call them terrorists. Mandela's a terrorist. Nasrallah gave a very, very great analysis of what's happening in Palestine. And not once did he really bring up religion. He was talking about power relations. He was talking about economy. He was talking about politics, about ecology. And he's saying that given what's happening in Gaza now, what's coming out of the resistance, the Muqawwama, as we would say in Arabic, Hamas and the other resistance organizations are not going to stop this time until the siege is lifted. That's their call. So in being in solidarity, what Palestinians might call in being in samud, in steadfastness and perseverance, we must heed that call. At the same time, we're heeding the other calls of BDS, of supporting other forms of nonviolent and violent resistance, of ending apartheid, occupation, and so forth. But in terms of this specific, what's happening in Gaza, the war on Gaza right now, the genocide on Gaza right now, the complete, the teaching of death of Israel against Gaza right now, it's to end the siege. That's the first call we take. And then we work from our positionalities, whether it's BDS or so forth, to be in solidarity.
What forms of solidarity do you see coming from the Israeli non-Arab population?
I mean, Israel is, and Israelis in general, the society is extremely anti-Palestinian and racist. That's a given. But that doesn't mean that Israelis have to be. And actually, there are many Israeli comrades, brothers, sisters, and everything in between who have been in solidarity and who have been working us since before. I mean, I don't want to say just Israelis, but also Jews who have been in solidarity. So in terms of what's happening in Gaza now, there have been protests in quote-unquote Israel, in Palestine 48, by Israelis. And they've been happening since the beginning in places like Jerusalem, in places like Tel Aviv, in Haifa, whether on their own or in camaraderie with Palestinian Israeli citizens. So there are many Israeli comrades. I mean, I just heard Ilan Pape speak a couple weeks back, and I was joking with him. I was in a room with him, and he was sitting down, and he asked me, "Why don't you want to come sit next to me?" And I said, "Ilan, it's because you're Israeli." And he said, "You're right. I wouldn't sit next to myself either." No, but Ilan is a great comrade, and there's many Israeli and Jewish comrades in Palestine, Israel, and elsewhere who are in solidarity and fighting the good fight.
Way earlier on in the conversation, you brought up the idea that people who are calling for or working towards the decolonization and liberation of Palestinian people and the land that they're on, I assume like the right to return being a part of that and all these other things, basically stopping the impositions that are being brought in by elements of the international community, in part led by the U.S., but mostly Israel, and our support for them. I guess, is there, in your mindset, kind of a Fanonian perception or conception of what that liberation between the two communities might look like?
I definitely, Fanon is one of our heroes, you know? I can't be certain. I feel like I've read somewhere that Fanon was actually in dialogue with Palestinians. I wouldn't doubt it. People like Ali Shariati in Iran, who translated The Wretched of the Earth into Farsi. I mean, we were all globally, we think we're connected now with Twitter and Facebook. Everyone was connected back then. Ali Shariati in Iran was meeting with PLO on Hajj, on the Muslim yearly pilgrimage in Mecca. So, I mean, since the beginning, we've been very influenced by each other, by the Caribbean philosophers like Fanon, by the Black philosophers, the Africana philosophers, and vice versa. I mean, now you see in Ferguson, people from around the country are heading to Ferguson, young and old, to go support, and this is the word people have used, to support the Intifada in Ferguson. So, no, it is a very Fanonian way of looking at things, to want to liberate not only the oppressed, but the oppressors. Ali Abu Nima, who is a very well-known writer and activist in the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the U.S., very famously quoted, "The struggle, the battle for justice in Palestine is not about a one or two state solution, but ultimately about a battle towards decolonization." And maybe in a similar way to anarchism, and you can clarify this or not, decolonization does not rely on the state to define ourselves. Because if you see the worlds that we live from, that existed in pre-modernized contexts, right? Because all of these systems are connected to a very specific moment of time, and that's modernity. But in pre-modernized context, whether that's the Ottoman Empire or Mesoamerica, we didn't have these issues with identity and superiority of race, this idea of racism. They didn't exist in the same ways. There was much more people, first and foremost, they didn't have that, or they related to it very differently, or it was an in-between space. It was a much more liminal space. I mean, even if you just look at Al-Quds, Al-Udus, Jerusalem, in the late Ottoman period, the last decade, the Ottomans were still holding on to Palestine, and you have the British moving in, the French moving in, cutting up, and Cycles Picot on the horizon. In Jerusalem, it was truly a cosmopolitan city. I mean, peoples from everywhere, Muslims, Jews, Christians, people who were Arabic speaking, Arabic was the language, Zoroastrians, you have Sunni, Shia, you have Armenians, people from many different places, and they all live next to each other. I don't want to say perfectly, I don't want to romanticize history, I don't think we should do that. There were problems, but no, these people, they sang each other's love songs. I mean, if you know Palestinian Muslims and Christians in certain places, often, you know, the Muslims will get baptized, or the Christians will fast during Ramadan, the Muslim holy fasting month. And I'm sure these practices existed amongst Muslim Jews and Christians and others before the Zionists colonized Palestine. So we have these histories within our peoples, but we really need to focus we need to focus on the larger picture, I think, which I think systems like anarchy and decolonialism and taking such a strong anti-state approach re-get back to that level.
We're speaking with Alexander Abbasi on the colonization of Palestine. More after this musical break.
Taking in college a course on African history prior to decolonization, basically, which is a huge amount of history to cover during a semester in college. But it was really fascinating in looking at the mess that colonization by European powers and the cutting up and checkerboarding of Africa because of the Berlin Conference, like, and then with the decolonization or the end of the colonial period. Into, I guess, what you could say is like the decolonizing, but really, not really post-colonial, sort of neo-colonial imposition mm-hmm. of capitalism. You've got people fighting along borders and identities that, before those borders were imposed, they were neighbors with each other, and maybe they had problems as communities, and maybe they didn't. But it's definitely now it's the power of the state backed by capital to create enough chaos in the area where you can dig out heavy metals and precious metals for iPads and crap like that, or yes. blood diamonds.
Yes. Two things. I mean, one is, what makes me different? What makes me allege myself to some form of power because I live on the other side of a river? I mean, it's just ridiculous. And this aspect about the resources, I mean, it's kind of really one of the major things affecting what's happening in Gaza. And in Palestine, they've found massive amounts of natural gas underneath Gaza. There's a part of me that doesn't want the Gazans to have it because I feel like it's going to turn into Qatar. It's going to turn into one of these Gulf states with just massive wealth and pillaging wealth. But this is another reason why the Israelis and the Americans and the Europeans want to control that region, not just Palestine. I mean, we have Cheney's energy companies in the Golan Heights. The Israelis are always fighting with the Lebanese over the natural gas in the Mediterranean right off the coast. Look what's happening in Iraq and in Syria with ISIS. Why all of a sudden, when we know that colonial powers created quote-unquote terrorists, when they created the rightist Islamic fundamentalists in the first place, all of a sudden now they take issue. Why? Because, excuse my friends, ISIS is getting its shit together. And they're creating a state, basically, and they're taking over the oil fields. So now that's when Obama wants to send in the drones and to send in the support. So this is very much about natural resources as well, like you said.
There's a part of me that thinks that when you were bringing up the natural gas under Gaza, it just made me think of, yeah, like there's definitely, like, yeah, it could turn into Qatar. They could be importing a bunch of, like, labor from the Philippines, you know, mm-hmm. and contributing in that way towards the people being displaced because of money. But I also thought, like, well, it's also going to destroy the nature of Palestine. It would destroy the land base and the water supply, which is already so damaged after years of colonialism. Wouldn't it be nice if we could live in a world where the world wasn't a resource? It wasn't something to be exploited, and it was not something to compete over.
Preach first. I mean, you're at Turtle Island right now, yeah. Which I'm kind of assuming is a very beautiful, naturey type place.
Well, that's a term for North America, called North America.
Please excuse my ignorance. I thought, is Turtle Island, is it in North Carolina, or where is it?
So, it's not, I'm not personally just there. Anyone in North America could be described as being on Turtle Island as a sort of idea of reframing it outside of the context of Amerigo Vespucci and Columbus and European contact, you know?
Oh, okay. So this is a Native American conceptualization from their point of view.
Yeah, from one specific tribe of people that's been since used as a term more widely among people that try to sort of reframe the land base that they're standing on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really use the term very frequently. I'm just starting to because I feel kind of a little bit unbalanced doing it, not really knowing, you know. But I guess Anishinaabe, Lenape, and Iroquois nations all used the Great Turtle or Hanuna, I guess. These sort of ideas or conceptions, the same basic like creation story for this land base that we're sitting on the back of a giant turtle.
But I do want to answer the question about kind of what the beauty of Palestine and what these things will do. I think I kind of saw it resurfacing on Facebook recently, but I remember in the 70s, King Faisal of the Saudi Arabian state cut off oil to the Western nations. And there's a famous quote that I'm not going to say it perfectly, but basically when they said, if you cut off oil, you know, we're going to destroy you. We're going to go to war with you. And King Faisal said, that's not a worry. Our peoples subsisted off of milk and dates for centuries. Cutting off oil is not going to harm us. So, I mean, if we can revive this type of connection to the land, because that's what it's really about. I mean, it's about the land. And that's the same thing, you know, in kind of new African or the liberationist African strands in the U.S., you'll hear the phrase, take back the land, take back the land. It's because colonialism has no connection to land. I mean, it has a connection, but it wants to abuse it. It wants to kill it. It wants to teach it death. But the indigenous perspective and the decolonial perspective, no, we love our land, and we want to actually treat it like our, you know, our baby, our mother. I mean, in Palestine, the figure of the land is so central. And interestingly, it's central as, and this is coming kind of from my religious studies. I graduated theological studies, and you know, I'm at Harvard Divinity School now. I mean, that doesn't sound the best coming off my tongue, Harvard. But I'm there for specific reasons. if we're not there, who's going to be there? Who's going to flip the table? You know. So one of the ancient Canaanite gods, and Canaanites being the people who inhabited what is Israel Palestine, historical Israel Palestine. One of their main gods was Anat, which was the moon goddess. And this symbol of the female is very strong in that area. And it's still very much strong. And it was absorbed because this is how Palestinians, how they related to their land and to their communities. If you look at the artwork, there's usually a woman in the center. And even in this article about Palestine and anarchism, the person is talking about issues around the overrepresentation of women in artwork and at protest on the front lines. But actually, there's really a lot of issues with gender, which is true. But I mean, and I'm not being an apologetic for historical patriarchy, but in many ways, these issues of sexism, these issues, I mean, they diagnose people with a disease called homosexuality that didn't exist in Palestine before the Europeans came. I mean, in many places around the world, whether it's the land or whether it's on Turtle Island right here, where you had Native Americans with this idea of the two-spirited being, and you have people who they actually view people who had an attraction to both female and male, whether they're male or male, as people who had magical powers, who had insight into this reality and ultimate reality. So, I mean, it's even on these micro levels of what they've done to our connection to the land, to each other, that it's very harmful. But I hope, like we're getting at, that we can kind of revive, because there's better worlds out there.
Yeah, I really hope so. The level of alienation from our own bodies, from our psyches, from our communities, and from the land bases we live on and interact with, it's pretty phenomenally horrible. And one of the articles that you passed to me, which I got a chance to read, it was the Logic of Israeli Violence by Greg Shupak, that's up on Jacobin Mag.
I think
made a very, very good argument of the fact that there's not any illogic to what's going on with the, you know, with the occupation of Palestine. It's a strangle, and then a punch, and then a, you know, that strangle suddenly feels better than being punched in the face, but it's populations being pulled off of their land, taken out of their houses destroyed, their olive trees being torn out of the ground and settlements being built there, and saying, oh yeah, we're not doing anything wrong, but these rockets keep attacking us, so we're gonna go in and like storm the land base or do air raids that just decrease the population of resistant people. In what Noam Chomsky, I think, very intelligently described as the world's largest open air prison.
Mm.
Making it so that, like, as it says in the article, this very conscious colonial project of attempting to destroy existing infrastructure and force the populations inside of that open air prison to be more reliant on the Israeli economy and the Israeli government.
Yeah, Greg did a great job at diagnosing the colonial intelligence that is Israel. And how that colonial intelligence is crystallizing itself up and over Gaza. To the point, I mean, it's not just about, I mean, you already mentioned everything. It's not just about, you know, bombing hospitals. It's not just about killing children. It's not just about shooting down the resistance and eradicating the resistance. It's about not even allowing the ability to rebuild hospitals, not even allowing the ability to reproduce. I mean, we're talking about chemical warfare here. I mean, it's they use white phosphorus in Operation Cast Lead. They brought back another white gas this time. They brought back illegal weapons. I'm forgetting the name now of these nails that, you know, cause extreme harm to the nervous system.
The flechettes that come from, they're not daisy cutters, but yeah, the bombs that are dropped that explode above ground and just send out all these little arrows, basically.
Yeah, Bruce. I mean, they want to turn us into frogs. They want to turn us, it's like nuclear waste. They want to make us be born with five eyes and six legs. And I mean, if someone's born that way, no offense to them. But I mean, it's just to the point of stopping the reproduction of all these systems of life. But you know what? They can't. And the resistance in Gaza is proving that they can't. I mean, the numbers now, if you just look at them. Okay, yes, around 2,000 civilians have been killed. 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed. Let's say 500, or almost 500 children. Those are the numbers out now. They say around 70 Israelis. But I've actually heard reports from people in Palestine that it's possibly even much, much more than that. But the Israelis don't want to admit it because they want to keep this image that they are the superior military power, which they are. But they're finding out that when they face Hamas on the ground in Gaza, when they show their face to our resistance fighters, they are getting beat up. And the resistance in Gaza has two Israeli soldiers now. And yes, they're going to use that for bargaining. So they can't. They're proving that they cannot diminish the will and the spirit of the Palestinian people. I mean, you want to try and kill 2,000 of us? And we were talking about Islamophobia earlier. Okay, Islam is not anti-sex. If anything, I would say it's the Euro-Christianity that's anti-sex, that hates the body, that doesn't, I mean, we don't have to get into these things, doesn't want to touch itself, that you can't even sleep next to each other at night. Islam is very pro-sex. Do you know how many babies a majority Muslim population in Gaza had? 5,000 kids. 5,000 breathing, living, heart-pumping children were born as they killed 2,000 of us. They will not kill us. They will not diminish us. The resistance lives on, and we will overcome this system, inshallah, very soon. I mean, I'm reading the anarchist article that you sent me, Anarchism in Palestine, and the person said that the first intifada began with a car accident. We're waiting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It can happen any time where this falls.
Where can people in the listening audience get a hold of some of your writing, or are there any specific news sources you think that they should pay attention to, or such around decolonization and also around resistance in Palestine?
Sure, some good sources online: Electronic Intifada, Palestinian run and centered; Mondo Weiss, MAAN, M-A apostrophe A-N, agency, MAAN news agency, which is based in Palestine. They have reporters in Palestine. I would say any non-Western media source is good. I mean, RT is good for certain things. You know, they kind of, they're unapologetic. I mean, they don't talk about Russia, but that's okay. Al Jazeera, even though Al Jazeera is increasingly becoming more mainstream, but Al Jazeera is good. Some blogs, 16 Minutes to Palestine, shout out to them. They put great stuff up there, both creative and other pieces. And Jadalia, Jadilyya, is also another great source for anything Palestine as well as Middle East related. The Jacobin, like you mentioned that article. Anyways, yes.
How did you spell Jadalia?
Jadalyya.
It's been really great talking to you, Alex, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Bruce. Thanks for reaching out.
Alexander Abbasi is a Palestinian-American living and studying in the U.S. We discuss a wide range of topics, starting off with our own personal views on political development, the decolonization of people and land bases, and the resiliency of people in the face of widespread murder and oppression by governments. You can find more of Alexander's writing by searching his name, A-B-B-A-S-I, on thecrimson.com, which is the website for the Harvard Crimson newspaper, youngist.org, youngist.org, smpalestine.com, and other websites. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org, soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show can be podcast from Radio for All and is archived a week after airing on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can contact us for ideas and comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.